Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. There was this TV show in the 1980s called The Facts of Life. You take the good, you take the bad, you take them both, and there you have the facts of life. Of course, you know that song. Well, it would be awesome if that show were to be revived. Until then, we have another option. It's called The Stats of Life. It puts a focus on the numbers that feature so prominently in the news and what they mean and how you can add real living people into the story. It's going to air soon on the CBC. We'll talk to the show's executive producer. Then, one for the history books. Every day, people pay for things, from groceries to bills to toys, new clothes, and we repeatedly swipe, tap, sign. We'll talk to the author of a new book on the payment system. Yep, you heard that right. He promised to touch on its entertaining history. You gotta tune in for that. And money on the mind. New research suggests that Canadians' workplace productivity can be affected by the stress of their personal finances. More from the Conference Board of Canada. Plus, women have more earning power than ever before, but are still less likely to use financial advisors than men. We'll learn more about an app called Joy that's working to change that. All that's ahead. Let's get started. Average. With a country as diverse as Canada, what does average really mean? The Stats of Life is a new four-part series from the CBC that asks just that. Executive producer of The Stats of Life, Kip Spittel, joins us now. Hello there.
Hi there.
What is The Stats of Life?
Stats of Life is a show which is a hybrid of a documentary series in which we look at Canadians across the country, but we intersperse their life experiences with statistics and how these experiences relate to the rest of us.
Is Tootie in the show anywhere?
No.
From that TV show Facts of Life? Because I really like that show, and I'm probably going to find a reason to work the theme song into this.
For copyright reasons, I cannot go further.
Darn, you have to like stop it. Well, what caught my eye here on the show idea was, of course, the episode on money. So what can viewers expect from that episode in particular?
Well, we follow three different families, and we try to make it as broad a range of Canadians as we can. But one of the families, our central family, is statistically average. In each of our episodes, we find the average family on some parameter which fits that theme. In this case, in money, it's income and assets. And we found the average family in Maple Ridge, British Columbia, who are earning the average amount of $80,940 a year and have about $82,000 in assets. And that creates an average family. So we follow them along and watch the issues that arose based on that theme.
For example,
lives.
What are some things that is an income that is obviously, I would say probably a living wage in that market, but it's not abundant. Money's not falling from the sky for that family. They don't have four hot tubs.
Very much so. No, even if Southern British Columbia, that things are a little tough. And at $81,000 a year, they have to make decisions based on, well, are we buying a new stove this year or next? Or in fact, that's the story we actually follow in that segment. But they have to decide whether they're going to spend money on their kids versus money on themselves. There's a lot of penny pinching involved. And that story allows us to riff on how so few Canadians have savings. Only one in five, they say, Canadian families have any emergency savings whatsoever.
How did you determine which statistics to focus on? Because, you know, when I talk about personal finance all the time, there's 50 that I would, you know, love to demonstrate. How did you figure out that those were the two that were going to be the most compelling?
We basically let the stories tell themselves. We followed the story that was happening in front of us, documentary style, and then found the statistics to match it. It was very much letting the story tell the stats.
Right. You have three families all told, so you have the average family. What about the outlier families? What was the essence of what you were telling there?
In the low outlier family is a family in Calgary, Alberta, where the husband's a geologist for Suncor, but in the about 5-6 years ago, lost his job working in Fort McMurray, lost a lot of money, started using credit cards to pay down debt, and their house was more expensive than they could afford. They eventually, after the fire, got relocated to Calgary, but are now in the situation where they're having to declare bankruptcy. So we follow what had been a middle-class family's sort of descent into poverty, and then following through to their first meeting with their bankruptcy trustee and how they went through and decided to make that call. The other family on the other side is a Toronto family whose assets are around $100 million and work about $8 million a year. And as such, their problems are different problems than the problems of the other families.
The typical 1% problems, to use the cliche.
Well,
where should we go on our sun vacation this year?
Well, the problem we actually follow is the fact that they bought a new $11 million house for the family, but hadn't shown the kids yet.
Oh.
So the kids were a little...
As a TV producer or documentarian, how did you engage in those stories in a way that didn't judge the magnitude of the problem in context? Because I can imagine for each of these three stories, there were parts that really resonated for you and parts that you just like raised your eyebrow and thought, really? Showing the kids that $11 million house, this is trauma? I just came from Calgary where they're talking about how to extend the chickpeas for another week.
Well, the challenge was definitely staying close to the story in front of us and not trying to bring any actual attitude to either side. And the CBC was actually very good with us that way. I thought perhaps that the alleged left-wing influence of the public broadcaster would push us to one direction or not, but they certainly hadn't, and wanted to be sure that every family had was, and we focused on, was very much friendly and accessible.
What do you want the viewer to take away from this?
Well, certainly in the money episode, I think takeaway is how many Canadians are in a precarious situation. That was a stat that I found most fascinating in producing this show, was the fact that there is a whole chunk of Canada which is called the precariat now, and just things living day to day, wage to wage. There is something people say 20% of people in Canada can't afford what would happen to them if they lost a paycheck, just a single paycheck.
Money is deeply personal. I've been focused on this for almost a decade, and one of the recurring themes is how hard it is for people to talk about. How did you find, as a TV producer, engaging with those families and having them open up and being just willing to have your cameras around while they fought, struggled, cried, all those emotions that would be likely correlate to the stories that you're talking about?
Well, it certainly was a case where I've always been amazed that people would open up on camera. As a TV producer, I'm very aware of the power that a camera brings and how you can, you know, set yourself up for a fall by saying the wrong thing. Whereas in all of these families we talked to, they were all remarkably open and very ready to help us out and tell us anything they had. They felt that what they were experiencing was something that they wanted to share with the rest of Canada. And it was much more difficult to find the very rich people to talk about money, but certainly it wasn't any difficult finding our middle class and our lower income family talk.
I know this is outside the mandate of the show that you've created, but were you left with some action items for our society here? Was there like, if only I could get on the phone with so-and-so, then we could address it? Or did you maintain the professional documentarian thing that you're just presenting what's so?
Well, favorite poet of mine, David Byrne, once said that facts will do what you want them to. And I think we were able to find and make it an authored piece. I think we were able to find the stories and the facts to support a sense of direction or a sense of focus on the show, in which we felt that the Canadians just needed to know more about how difficult things were for the rest of us. Mm. I think I'm certainly living in Toronto. It's hard to know just how the rest of Canada is really struggling these days. And I think it's become more and more obvious. We deal with stats about income disparity, which is an enormous problem. And that's probably the biggest societal issue we're going to have facing going ahead. And we don't ignore it. We talk about it. We don't pin it on our rich family either. It's more of a societal issue than their problem.
What did you notice about your family's level of insight as the project unfolded? Because I can imagine they thought about and talked about it in different ways simply because they were a part of this construct. And one of the, you know, certainly there is the level at which circumstances drive their reality. And then there's the layer that is individual behavior that drives the reality. It's a combination of those two things for any family. But what would you say about their own journey and what they might have learned for themselves having gone through it?
Well, I think it's remarkable how much financial knowledge is available to Canadians and how people like yourself are constantly letting people know some smart techniques and some thoughtful ways of approaching income and money spending. And I think that there's actually a higher level of sophistication, I think, across the country than I expected. And I think that all the families we talked to were very cognizant of the issues involved, and certainly around their own issues. They knew what was available to them. They knew what they got in the situations they were in, but they also knew that some cases a rolling snowball just continues to get bigger.
As I mentioned off the top just before we go, this is a four-part series. One is focused on money. Can you give us a teaser for what the other episodes are going to talk about?
Well, the first episode, which premieres on the 24th, is on dating. The second episode, yes, money. The third one will be about Canadian homes, and the last one about food.
Ooh, what are you going to do in food?
We're following food spend on three different families. We've got a family in in Winnipeg, which spends the average amount per week and eats the average amount of meals as a family. But we also have a family in North Toronto that hosts a Seder dinner constantly every weekend. And so, yeah, cooks for 40, 50 people every week.
Wow. See, it all ties back to money. See, food spending. Kip, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Bruce.
Kip Spiddell is the executive producer of a new show coming up on the CBC called The Stats of Life.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Every day, people all over the world pay for things. We tap, swipe, insert, we ask for change, we sign receipts, totally unaware of how these various payment systems came to be. But our next guest does. He studied this in depth. Kasra Najatian is the author behind A Payment History of the United States, a book that explains why payment systems work the way they do and gives a brief history behind the reasons why each was set up. He joins us now from Palo Alto, California. Hello there.
Thanks for having me today.
This sounds like the most boring topic in the history of publishing. I cannot imagine anything more boring, and you decided to write a book on it. Why on earth did you decide to write this book?
You're starting to sound a lot like my wife now.
So
I started getting interested in the world of payments when I was a kid. I come from an immigrant family. We moved from Iran to Toronto when I was 12, and we did what all immigrant families do, which is open up corner stores. And I was the nerdy kid when I was 13 or 14 who was responsible for getting the merchant payment statements from our banks and figuring out how much money we had made. So I noticed that we were spending a lot of money getting paid from people. So I started, being interested in point-of-sale systems and how money works as a teenager. And it's gone downhill since then.
Oh, my gosh. You must have had some really funky glasses in high school. I mean, just to fit the whole picture there. But this is radio. I can't see that. But what I can ask you is, what are some of the seminal moments in history? I did a history of the skyscraper once, a story on the history of the skyscraper. And the seminal moment was not reinforced steel. It was fluorescent light. It was very surprising. So as you look back over the arc of history, what are some of the big changes? What are some of the big things that happened?
The really interesting thing about the history of payments is that some of the biggest moments of payments history have a lot to do with Canada. This, we don't think of Canadians as being, part of the money movement in the world, but they really do. Let me give you an example. The idea of money backed by government as opposed to, specie, which is gold or silver, really came about because the then colony of Massachusetts really didn't have much going for it in terms of industry. So the way the Massachusetts government would fund itself is by attacking Quebec every few years. And it's in the 1600s. And one of these attacks would typically go well. They would come back with money, and that money or gold would fund the government of Massachusetts. But one of these attacks didn't go very well. So the government of Massachusetts found out after the attack that they had no money to pay the soldiers, and all these soldiers had guns and were asking for their salary. So money, the idea of money backed by government, was invented because the government didn't have gold. So that was happening in the 1600s. The second most interesting thing is banking. The world of banking changed a lot dramatically in the early 1900s, where all these big private banks were flourishing all over the world, But specifically in Canada and the United States, there's a period of free banking that allowed us to create a method of payment that was accepted by all of them. Because really, for most of the 1800s, every bank had their own currency, and it was all very complicated to figure out. So it wasn't really until 1900 that all these banks started flourishing and doing well as businesses that we managed to settle money down in North America. And that's a relatively recent thing when you think of it.
How did paper currency come to be? It's so funny to think now that we're getting rid of paper currency in so many ways that was a big innovation at the time.
Yeah, so paper currency started coming about because there was a shortage of gold in North America. So, you know, these American colonies didn't have enough gold or silver. So what they would do is they would issue paper debt against the government. So the government would give you, you know, when they owed you money, they would give you, you know, a piece of paper that said the government of, you know, New Hampshire owes you, you know, $200 in gold. And you would take that money and you would, you know, give it to someone else when you had gotten from government. And it turns out that people back then didn't really want to accept a paper currency. They're like, this feels like a scam because they were used to getting gold coins or at the time, really, Spanish gold coins. But so the governments of these colonies passed laws that make it illegal to not accept this paper currency on par with gold. And that's how they got stretched out. What happened was, you know, governments in these colonies were spending too much money and didn't have gold, so they invented paper currency.
The Charge-It story, the sort of beginnings of the credit card world is fascinating. The credit cards went from 1 million cards in 1958 to 100 million just 12 years later. Take us to Fresno, California, and tell us as briefly as you can, but tell us what they did to drive market penetration on cards.
Yeah, this is a Bank of America story. It's called the Fresno Drop, which is fascinating. Everyone had failed to build a credit card system because it turns out they couldn't get enough consumers or they couldn't get enough merchants to get credit cards due. So Bank of America decided what they were going to do is just without knowing anything about anyone in Fresno, California, they were going to mail everyone in the city a credit card. With a $500 limit and say, look, now we've solved the problem of consumers not having credit cards. Dear businesses, everyone in Fresno has a credit card. Please start accepting it. And the fascinating thing was, you know, the businesses loved the idea, especially in the lead up to Christmas, because the alternative choice would have been people writing checks back then. So it was, you know, just a typical two-sided marketplace problem that Bank of America completely ignored all the risks and just gave everyone credit cards.
Wow. Now, history is an amazing, amazing teacher if we listen to it. What lessons are there? What lessons are there for the taking when it comes to the history of payments?
So payment innovations happen very, very slowly. And then without you realizing it, it just takes over. This is the story of debit cards, checks, credit cards. Checks were invented in the 1600s, but did not become in wide usage until like the 1950s and 1960s. So it took, you know, 350 years for them to become broadly used. Same with credit cards and debit cards and even dollar currency, like paper currency. So the fascinating thing to pay attention in the world of payments is to pay attention to really small trends that are happening that are gaining little traction but won't go away. And those things typically end up being very big, in 10, 20, 30 years. And that's what's so fascinating with cryptocurrency these days, that there isn't a lot of transaction happening in these things, but there wasn't a lot of transactions happening on debit cards in the first 40 years of debit cards' existence.
I'm afraid I've only got 30 seconds left, but in that 30 seconds, I want your one bold prediction about what history would say about the future. What should we watch?
I think they would be shocked that we transact as much as we do and spend as much money as we do as easily as we do, because for much of history, this was really, really hard.
Where will things go? Will Bitcoin take over the world?
I think not. I actually think Bitcoin won't take over the currency world, but I think we will use Bitcoin just like we use computers today in 50 years from now, but probably not as our main way of paying for things, but probably for way of, you know, storing our investments or you are interacting with our banks. I think you'll still be spending Canadian dollars at the store or the US dollars at the store.
Interesting. Well, I look forward to your sequel, Kasra. I can't imagine what you will write about next, but I'm sure it will be an equally boring headline with a very interesting narrative. Thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kasra Najarian is the author of A Payment History of the United States. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, you've heard about robo-advisors, right? Well, what about a robo-planner? We talked to the founders of ViviPlan about how automation can make handling your personal finances that much easier. And later, if you're like me, sometimes you just can't get money off your mind, even at work. We'll talk about new research that suggests financial stress could be affecting your productivity. Follow me at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Selary on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Hello, I'm Bruce Selary. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Technology has transformed so many areas of our lives. Hailing a cab, renting a room, seeing photos of what strangers are eating for dinner right now. But so far, technology hasn't done that much to help you set up a financial plan. A real live financial planner can look at the big picture and figure out what you need to do to achieve your long-term goals. But where's the AI-assisted hyper-tech version of that? Rona Birnbaum and Seon Vas are the co-founders of ViviPlan, a robo-financial planner that won first prize in the Ryerson DMZ BMO FinTech Accelerator program last week. Well, that's a big mouthful. They join us now to talk about their new product. Hello there to you both.
Good morning, Bruce.
ViviPlan, ViviPlan. Which is it?
It's ViviPlan.
ViviPlan. Okay. So first, Rona, how did this come about?
Well, this started from a problem that I had in my business, and the best businesses come out of solving a problem, and that is in my fee-only financial planning practice, we were turning away clients every day because we didn't have the capacity. So there was more demand than we had time for. We hired, we doubled our staff. So just more people wanting independent, unbiased, fee-only advice and a capacity constraint. So I met Seon. And he's got a technology background, and he was looking for a problem to solve with technology. And he asked me what the biggest problem was, and I said, scale. How do you scale this business? If you can figure out how we can get more people really solid, actionable financial plans using technology and cost-effectively, then let's work together.
So, Seon, how does this actually work? I watched the demo video,
but give
our listeners the lay of the land.
Definitely. I mean, I think there's two things. So one is, how does it work right now? And then the other part is, how does it work in the future? Where do we see this going? So right now, just to kind of give the value prop of what we do, what we're doing is fee-only financial planning is a service that is tremendously valuable to Canadians because they get unbiased financial plans. They know that the plan they're getting is actually in their best interest. The problem is it costs between $3,000 and $8,000.
Yep.
So and the reason for that is because it takes 18 hours potentially of human actual planner time to create that plan. So what we do is we're automating lots of the parts of the human labor involved in creating a financial plan. So the first part is rather than a planner having back and forth email, in-person meetings, all just to collect information, we have an online portal that collects all that user information, helps the client understand how to answer questions, where they need to get documents. So completely removing the human mental task on that end. That's the first part. The second part, which we're working on right now, is rather than a planner taking that information and putting it into an online engine manually, why can't you automate that? Why can't you have that data automatically connected to an engine and process that way? That's the second part of it. And the third part of it, real quick, is one of the largest reasons is that financial documents currently, pension statements, insurance policies, tax returns, planners are manually going through these documents to find what's actually important in that document and relevant to that client. So how do you have, what's typically called in technology an OCR pipeline, an optical character recognition pipeline that can automatically go through that document, see what's important, and rather than a planner doing that, you can have a computer do that.
Rona, what does it cost and what's the output? Mm-hmm. What do you get? Mm-hmm. So you spend all this time as the retail investor, as the consumer, mm-hmm. inputting all this info. Mm-hmm. You pay some money to your firm. Mm-hmm. What do you get? Well, how much do you pay and what do you get?
So our comprehensive plan is $800. And we have some lighter versions where individuals might be looking for very simple feedback, and those are lower priced. But the full plan is really where you get all the power from, and all the information and education and empowerment from. And what you get as far as an output is concerned is not all that different than what we deliver on the full service side. So it's a comprehensive report that is a combination of numbers and charts, but more importantly, text, specific actionable steps that clients should take to move them towards their, you know, short-term, mid-term, and long-term goals, whatever they're defined as. So it's really not a simple, well, you should save X dollars a month and you'll retire okay. It's not that at all. It's you can save X dollars a year in 2018 and 2019, but in 2020, daycare starts.
Right.
So you're going to have to take an RSP hiatus for a little while, and then it's going to be able to pick up. And so it's very sensitive to both changes in cash flow, changes in tax position. And so from a cash flow standpoint, it's very specific. And then beyond that, it's things like, okay, if you're underinsured and you need disability insurance, what are the kinds of coverages you should consider? How do you compare group and individual coverage? Very specific, actionable things. It could be something like, well, take the money that's sitting in your TFSA account and pay down your credit card. Mm. So, you know, it's really not just charts and graphs and simple things like do A, B, or C. It's very, very detailed.
Sayan, what was the hardest part to design?
Yeah, I mean, this is, with any tech product, it's always a constantly iterating process. You're constantly getting feedback from people, redesigning. In terms of the hardest part to design, that's kind of what we're building right now, which is that document processing engine. And that's generally a complex task because you need a lot of data and you need to build the algorithms to process the data. So right now, it's that part's still on the human end, but that's what we're excited to build. And that's the part that's going to be the hardest to design. How do you really intelligently go with an insurance policy?
Rona, you ask about goals in this process for a consumer. Obviously, everybody does that. But what you did that I love and fits with my worldview is you also ask why a goal is important. Why did you include that step in there?
I think it's very important to connect to what is the essence or the reward for a particular goal, because a goal that is something that is achievable over more than a week. In other words, you have to work at it for more than a week to get it. You're going to need a fair bit of motivation and incentive to make that happen. So connecting to the purpose and the payoff is one way I've learned over the years that allows people to stay determined, committed, and trade off action towards that goal from something else that might give them some immediate satisfaction.
Sayan, there's a question in there about what's unique about your circumstances. So you're asking the consumer to address that. What sort of things are you looking for, and how does that affect the model?
Yeah, I think every person's financial situation is completely unique. And we want to make sure that an online platform is still able to capture the nuances about that person's situation. So it could be the fact that, you know, they're kind of debating whether they want to retire at age 66 versus age 70, right? So it's really nuances that are very unique.
Maybe
to them.
I'm going to have another kid.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Maybe I'm going to have an affair, you know, leave my marriage. Do you get
they plan
some,
an
like,
affair 4 years
right.
in advance, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
totally.
Why not?
That.
Yeah.
Now, when you were testing it out, what were the hurdles, say, on for people completing it? Because one of the things we know from a usability standpoint is people are super weird about how we engage with technology. And as
sure.
a designer, you think, what's the big deal? It's no, like you're uploading a document. What were some of the things that surprised you that people got stuck on that you thought, like, really?
Yeah, I think people get stuck purely, first of all, because of the volume of questions.
Right.
So that's like a important part of kind of our thinking behind this. We could have designed like a shorter questionnaire, but then it's a lightweight plan. The plan they get isn't actually what's best for them. So the system processes 300 to 500 questions. So it's a lot of questions. So really the design problem is, how do you get people to answer all those questions, you know, ideally in a shorter time frame?
How long would it take to answer all those questions? 2 hours?
It varies depending on the individual. So feedback so far has been, I think the most organized individuals will do it in an hour to an hour and a half. And those are individuals that already know where their money is, how much they're spending on certain things. They're in touch with the financial side of their lives. For those that are feeling disconnected, it could take them on and off days. Like it, they could go in and then take a break and then go in. So we make it so that you don't have to do it all at once. And in addition, sometimes people don't know where to get the information that we're asking for.
Right.
So for example, the CPP statement. So we provide info bubbles that says, okay, you call this number and you ask these questions and this is how you get this information. And we ask a question maybe about insurance. Well, you can request a policy summary from your insurance agent. So it could take a few days, and it could, there are some people that started a few weeks ago and they're still working through it. So then it's our job to go back and say,
hey,
how you doing?
Yeah. How you doing? I'll send you a cupcake. Rona, one last question. When does your product not make sense for people?
It doesn't make sense for individuals with complex planning needs. And that would, good examples of that would be individuals with cross-border tax issues. I would say incorporated individuals with complex affairs like family trusts, corporate holding companies, you know, very successful business owners, those kinds of things. Individuals, what I would also say is probably best to deal with a full service planner would be blended families. So if you've got a second or third marriage, you've got children from prior marriages, and the estate planning piece becomes very complex. Right. This is not designed for that.
Well, thank you both very much for your time. I'll be interested to see how it unfolds.
We'll keep you posted.
I bet you will. Rona Birenbaum and Seon Voss are the co-founders of VivaPlan, a robo-financial planner that just won first prize in the Ryerson DMZ BMO FinTech Accelerator program. Well, stay with us. Coming up later, the Moolala Questionnaire. But next, Money on the Mind, how your personal finances could be affecting your productivity at work. Talking about work, I also work as the financial columnist for CityLine, the lifestyle show. You can check out CityLine segments at cityline.ca and search for some of the stuff that we do there. We are on the air across Canada and now in the U.S., which is kind of cool. We'll be right back.
Listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I'm Bruce Ellery. You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple. Getting a handle on your finances can be stressful, and sometimes that stress can filter into your everyday routines, including work. New research from the Conference Board of Canada suggests that Canadians' workplace productivity can be affected by the stress surrounding their personal finances. Greg Sutherland is a principal economist at the Conference Board and one of the authors behind the new research titled Money on the Mind, Financial Wellness and Its Impacts on Individuals, Business and Society. He joins us now from Ottawa. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
This makes intuitive sense. Of course, if you're stressed about, you know, making ends meet, that's going to affect you in the workplace. But how did your study try and quantitatively demonstrate this link between financial wellness and its impact in the workplace?
Well, it's kind of a new field of research that you can have. Like, it's all about stress, and we've heard about the health effects of stress and what they can do to maybe your mental state of mind and your physical health. But we wanted to take a look at how the financial impact or financial stress can also affect that part of your life.
And what did you find? I mean, when we talk about stress generically, it has an impact, but were you able to look at financial stress versus being in the sandwich generation or having a cancer diagnosis? Or, you know, was there any way to provide context on how financial stress stacks up?
Well, actually, not to be a spoiler, but that's an area of future research that we are planning to go down. And then kind of the next or the upcoming reports. Purpose of this of the reports we just released was to kind of get a lay of the land about how Canadians feel about their finances and kind of introduce how stress or financial stress can kind of impact health. It's not really At this point in time, we can't really say that your stress is, 30% financial or
right.
or 70% physical or health related. But we just wanted to open the door to the fact that that there are financial issues that Canadians have. It does affect them, or it does affect their levels of stress. They can take this to work, and then all in all, it can affect their productivity at work as well.
Be sure to factor in your dopey boss when you try and triage what the biggest challenges are. What were the big findings for you as you did this research? I skimmed through it. There's tons of material there. What for you was most resonant?
Yeah, you can go many different directions with the type of data that's available, and it's really kind of new data as well. This is something that the government is now tracking. But one thing, what we were trying to get is the whole idea of financial wellness, where you have your financial health and your financial well-being, and your financial health is kind of your objective features like your income, your financial literacy, your savings, your retirement planning, and then there's financial well-being, and it's how you feel about all that stuff, your sense of security, your sense of making proper financial choices. So we kind of stack those together to come up with overall financial wellness and how Canadians are being affected, or how their financial wellness is affected. And one thing we do, just kind of a lay of the land that I talked about, is we're finding that a lot of Canadians they feel like they are knowledgeable about finances, but when you get down to it, there's only 75 or less than 75% are planning for retirement. Many of them, about half of them, don't do basic financial activities. They don't prepare a budget. They don't use their credit wisely, mm-hmm. and they go into a little much debt. They aren't saving for retirement. So things that may seem like the first step in the financial planning world is something that that many Canadians don't even go down for a number of reasons too. It's not just one reason, but
one number that really surprised me: 74% of Canadian employers feel that they have a responsibility to help their employees with their financial wellness. So then, why is so little being done about it?
Well, yeah, it kind of all came to a head, I guess, in the financial crisis of almost 10 years ago now. And more organizations are providing defined contribution plans as opposed to defined benefit plans. So there's this, employers now maybe feel like they need to help their employees with this type of, or this aspect of their life. Now, what's being offered now, it appears, is just information. This is our financial plan. This is what we offer as an organization. If you need some assistance, call this number. We do provide some help with financial assistance. Or if you're not feeling, or if you're feeling financial stress, we have people that we can talk to. They probably need to go a step further.
You're being very kind.
But get people to change their behavior. If financial their financial wellness is being affected, get people to change their behavior. Maybe get secure more resources. Do more than provide information. Tailor financial wellness programs or initiatives to specific individuals based on their age, their income. Because everyone, in an organization would have different financial targets, if you will, financial planning targets. So it's probably the next step. It's still, research is very, it's in its early stages, and just getting to the next steps and how that can improve employees overall.
Well, the continuation on that theme, your report said 20% of organizations have a strategy in place, but some of the examples that you gave don't sound particularly strategic to me. Like a 1-800 number does not a financial wellness plan make.
Exactly. And that's, like we said, it was only 20%. So the organizations are good at providing the basic info, but an actual strategy is something that it's in its infant stages right now. So, getting senior leadership to buy in, showing that these financial wellness initiatives are valuable. There has to be some sort of measurement capacity as well, and maintaining momentum as well. Once employees sign up for these or use the resources, there has to be something, you know, to keep them in the program or make other employees join the initiatives. And there has to be value demonstrated as well. So as we move along and see how much value employees get out of it, then we'll see how well these initiatives work.
Is there a call to action in the reports that you have published here? What do you want employers to be doing differently?
I think it's kind of what I was referring to before. We want them to maybe make the next steps. We know from the study that there are Canadians who aren't planning for retirement. There are a certain number of Canadians that don't feel knowledgeable about financial matters. So it's all about kind of recognition and providing the resources to help them in this area, especially if it affects their workplace performance. So setting the resources aside and getting employees to participate. You mentioned before how participation seems to be on the low side. Just increasing that rate of participation, just communicating that this is an employee or an organizational initiative. This is not about pointing fingers at a certain number of employees. It's all about wellness of the entire organization.
Right.
The value needs to be demonstrated. There needs to be ways to measure the success of these initiatives.
Right.
Just to show that there is that value for employees.
Greg, I'm afraid we need to leave it there. Thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Greg Sutherland is a principal economist at the Conference Board and one of the authors behind some research entitled Money on the Mind, Financial Wellness and Its Impacts on Individuals, Business and Society. Well, stay with us. Coming up next, the language of financial services is intimidating. We'll learn more about a new financial coaching app designed with women in mind. And we'll take you through the Moolala questionnaire. Sign up for our newsletter at moolala.ca. Subscribe to the podcast version of the show on iTunes. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Women have more earning power than ever before and are more likely to control their own finances, but they are less likely than men to engage on the topic of their money. The language can be intimidating, coming off as overbearing or aggressively masculine, says Scott Saunders. He is the CEO of Payoff and the creator of Joy, a personalized financial coaching app targeted towards women. He joins us from Ocean Ridge, Florida. Hello there.
How you doing, Bruce?
You hired the data scientist from eHarmony, the dating website. Why?
Because psychology is a missing piece of managing one's finances. And if you want to make the process more human, you've got to add the psychological component. We're all very different from a psychological perspective. Our psychology has a huge impact on what we do with money. And our financial situations impact our psychology greatly. High levels of debt, low levels of savings create tremendous financial stress. And we just felt like psychology is really the driver of behavior, and it needed to be a factor where we not just think about financial optimization, but think about psychological optimization as well. And really combining psychology and money to help people live happier lives, that is what we do as a company. And we're the only company that really is innovating at that intersection of both psychology and finance.
So how does Joy work?
So Joy is a free app today available in iOS. And essentially Joy is a robot money coach that learns about your psychology and then builds a robot that's custom tailored to you based on your unique psychological characteristics. And the purpose of Joy is to help you spend happier and save money. So those are the two things that we're really focused on within Joy. In terms of the spending happier, you link your financial accounts that you spend on, whether it's a credit card, debit card, and you rate your spending transactions on how you feel about them after the fact. You spend $50 here, $25 there. How do you feel? Does this make you happy or sad? You click the happy face or the sad face. And what this essentially does is allows you to customize the experience. And we can serve those insights back to you. And it's a very non-judgmental approach to your finances. We find that a lot of budgeting tools are very judgmental, and they decide sort of what's important. But what we've learned from the research is that people's happiness about spending on particular things varies greatly based on their psychology, based on who they are. And so we wanted that reflected within the experience of the app. So the first thing you're doing is spending happier. We want you to review those spends that you make and decide how you feel about them. And the goal is, you know, we want more happy spends and fewer sad spends. That really is the goal there. So the second thing that we do is we use our artificial intelligence that is analyzing the cash flow in your checking account, and we suggest daily amounts that you're safe to save. So you're safe to save $15. That goes into your Joy savings account. And we want to just develop the habit of savings, really getting people to kind of go back and see how many days in a row that they can save money. And they can, you know, they can easily transfer that money back into their checking account if need be. But we want to help people develop the daily habit of savings.
Now, you're talking about matching users to sort of, I don't know if there are archetypes of AI coaches. Does this mean that one personality would get Oprah and the other one would get Dr. Phil?
That is a good way to think about it. There essentially are four different coaches, and we're looking at, we first go through, you take a little gamified assessment so that we can understand your psychology, and we tell you upon doing that what your financial personality is. Your financial personality is your dominant psychological characteristic. And we're using a very widely tested around the world, academically validated framework called OCEAN. OCEAN stands for openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. So let's say that on the extroversion scale, you're off the charts. You're super high in terms of extroversion.
That's accurate in my particular case.
you're gonna be a storyteller. That's the archetype, and you are a storyteller, Bruce. And that's gonna give us a lot of insight. It's not gonna tell us everything there is to know about you, but it's gonna tell us a lot in terms of what you might be really good at with your finances, where the challenges might be. And so we'll then reveal to you the financial personality through the app. And that's kind of step one. Step two is we actually look at several psychological characteristics to make the match to one of the right four coaches. So a little bit of that, you know, eHarmony matching, if you will, kind of back in terms of the algorithm and getting you connected up with the right coach. And the whole conversational tone and the pathway that we present to you in the experience layer of the app is different based on who that coach is. Just different tone of voice, different discussion that you're having, and it's very conversational. There's a kind of text back and forth format.
Now, you didn't start out trying to create an app for women, as I understand it. In fact, I understand you're an all dude team, at least in the beginning. Briefly, how did it come to be that that's what this ended up being? And what are the real differences that you would identify between the genders? Because there's so much written about this and some of it's bunk.
Yeah. So the team that was building Joy happened to be an all guys team. The company has a very high percentage of women overall in the company. But we did reach out and work with an agency in New York, Allison Broad, that predominantly does fashion, beauty, and lifestyle. And we started collaborating with her with the idea, not initially of just focusing on women, but the idea of building a consumer lifestyle brand rather than just a financial brand. We think, you know, most financial companies aren't that cool. And so a lot of people don't pay attention to them. We wanted to build something that was cool, something that was culturally relevant, something that was unconventional and highly differentiated and more likely to resonate, not just with women, but I would say more likely to resonate with people that were more non-finance types. We think there are a lot of finance people in finance, if that makes sense. And so I think, you know, as we looked at the way that financial services were delivered, we felt like it was incredibly transactional, short term, you know, quite competitive and, you know, and very industrially focused. And we wanted to do something that was more relational, more long term, more cooperative, you know, greater degree of emotion. And these are psychological characteristics that really, you know, women have. Women are, you know, greater in terms of their ability to nurture. And they approach the world in a different place. And I think the lack of women in finance has really led to these financial products and services being delivered in a way that doesn't represent the fullness of humanity.
Right.
In terms of the importance of women, at the end of the day, women really are the buyer of these services to begin with. Mm. 85% of consumer spending is driven by women. 89% of new bank accounts are instigated to be opened by women. They're also a lot more likely to share about a product or service with their friends than men.
Right.
And they really are the strategic customer. And I really feel like, you know, millennial women in particular are closest to cultural change in terms of what's going to be cool, right? They're the tastemaker of society. And if you look at these platforms like Instagram and Snapchat, were all brought to scale by women. So our thought was, golly, we
got to capture this. We got to get in there.
Focus here.
Scott, I wish we had more time. We could talk about this for hours longer, but I'm afraid we're out of it. I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Scott Saunders is one of the creators behind Joy, a personal finance coaching app targeted towards women. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. This is our series of questions about money, a little bit about life. Kip Spittel is the executive producer and showrunner of CBC's new show, The Stats of Life. He is our guest today. Hello there.
Hiya.
Okay, so first thing that comes to your mind, how would you describe your money personality?
Tight.
Oh, tight. Wow, that's a very like visual and emphatic word. Twas ever thus, or is this a new phenom?
No, twas ever thus.
And why do you think that is?
I don't enjoy shopping, and so it just doesn't. I don't spend it.
Right, you just don't spend money. Yeah. So what do you do around holidays? There's a certain cultural expectation around birthdays and around the holidays that come at the winter time that people spend.
Well, I tend to spend on my loved one, and that's where the money usually goes.
Right, but you are tight. Has this ever got you into trouble?
No.
Being tight? Really?
No.
Oh, see, I used to be, I would say, tight, and then I received some very clear feedback that when it came to splitting the restaurant bill, I was officially cheap and would no longer be invited over for beers anymore if we didn't go 50-50. So you have lived your life with no consequences of your tight behavior.
That's correct.
Wow. What does financial freedom mean to you?
That's retirement.
Okay. And when will you retire and what will you do?
Well, that is the biggest challenge because I'm a freelancer.
Oh, so you've got money stashed in every single cupboard of your house. Bills, 20s, just...
Nickels.
Yeah,
dimes.
You're a freelancer in the entertainment business, which is just even worse. But seriously, when do you think you will retire?
Well, hopefully not until I want to and not until I need to. I think it'll be probably, well, I'd hope to work till I'm 70.
Okay. Who was your money mentor? And what did they demonstrate or model or show you?
It would be my father and his ability to constantly save nickels here and there and put money aside on a constant basis to just constantly build a savings account.
Buy a potato and eat it for a week?
Something
that kind
nature.
Of thing. Yeah, a potato and some ketchup. And you were good to go. All two food groups were covered there. What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures?
Fine bourbon.
Fine bourbon. Okay, what's an example of a fine bourbon? It could be a brand or it could be like a type of burb that goes into the bourbon.
Remember, this is coming from a place of tightness. So it's...
Do you get it at Costco?
No.
Do you get your bourbon at Costco?
I have not shopped for bourbon at Costco.
Oh, okay.
No, I bought the Gentleman Jack. It's Jack Daniels is my standard, but the higher end one is the Gentleman Jack. A little smoother, a little long.
How much would
age.
A bottle of Gentleman Jack be?
Oh, it's another $15.
It's another $15. Yeah. And what would the guest have to do or have to be for you to open up the Gentleman Jack?
Smiling.
Smiling. So if they were smiling, they might get the good stuff.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, it's like you might not even offer them any Jack at all.
They can get the bad stuff.
What was your worst financial mistake? Aside from pursuing a career in television, which was a terrible idea, and if anyone could have told you, you should have become an engineer. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah, it's a little late for that one. My biggest financial mistake probably was not putting as much in my RSPs when I was younger, in my 30s, in the 20s and 30s.
If you landed a huge financial windfall, and I'm calling $25 million huge, to you might that might be chump change, but to me it's huge. What would you do with it?
Oh, I'm thinking Warm Island.
A warm island. And would you leave the glamour of television behind, or would you continue to?
A drop of a hat. Yeah. $25 million. I love my job, but not that much.
If you could, so you have done this this television show, as we've mentioned, The Stats of Life. You've focused on money. You have a new insight, I assume, into how this world works for people. If you were to try and choose one thing that you learned from this project as it relates to personal finance, what would you say it is?
I would say it's putting money aside earlier. I think that that thing that bugs me now is the thing that should have bugged me then. You know, it's, and I think that's something that everyone else should do too. It's putting a little bit aside every week. Just let it build. It'll build on its own. Compound interest is a gift from God.
Have you kept this wisdom to yourself, or do you harass anyone under the age of 30? Kip's got some wisdom here. You must sit and listen to Papa Kip.
I try to communicate by example.
Oh, right. I'm much more emphatic. I'm barky and I point. But, you know, different strokes for different folks. One last question, and that is this. What is the greatest societal intervention you think we could make to make a sustained difference in how Canadians are with their money?
Well, I think it's a tough call. But right now, I think income disparity is the biggest issue. So something that would deal with that.
Right.
And I think it's more progressive taxes. Maybe it's a bit more of a guaranteed income for the poor. It's something has to give, because right now we're on a collision course, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Kip, thank you for your perspective and your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce.
Kip Spedal is the executive producer of CBC's The Stats of Life. Well, that's our program for today. Thank you very much for listening. You can drop us a line to ask@moolala.ca. That's moolala.ca. You can also find me on social media. Twitter is @BruceSelry. Facebook is BruceSelry Moolala. And I don't do anything else. I just can't be bothered. To listen to past episodes of this show, you can go onto iTunes and they will be there. You can also go to moolala.ca and you can download not only the whole podcast, but you can also listen to a specific segment. How cool is that? Please review us, subscribe to our next episode. We would be forever grateful. And we are grateful that you joined us today. Thanks very much. Have a great day.